Hello, all you conscious equestrians. Thank you so much for tuning in again for another episode of our podcast. Today, I've got a really interesting guest for you. His name is Henry Boswell. He's a dressage rider, so some of you dressagey types might have heard of him. He's had a massive amount of success from ponies right the way through up to senior Grand Prix. He's still a super rider and he's also a super coach. I have it on very good authority. And he talked about all kinds of things, you know, to do with dressage, to do with riding in general. And it makes for a really interesting episode, I think. As ever, if you love the podcast, please give us a 5-star review and do share. Thank you very much.
Hi guys, I'm Henry Boswell. I'm a dressage rider. Have been competing in dressage since I was 15. I've competed for Great Britain as a young rider, a junior and a pony rider, and still aim to do so as a senior.
Cool. And where are you based, Henry?
I'm based in Warwickshire and train Kate Lister's and Margaret Lister's horses daily, and also do some freelance coaching in between.
Cool. Okay. And if you could describe a normal day for you, what would that entail?
So normal day, I get on the first horse about 7 over at Brompton Stud, where I've got a lovely little stallion called Firecracker that I ride. And then from there, I head over to the Lister's place and ride their horses. And I usually finish riding about 1:15 or something, and then start teach all afternoon.
Cool.
Do that. I do that Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, and then Wednesday and Saturday I tend to kind of teach all day.
Cool. And you compete as well, obviously.
Yeah, still competing, you know, as much as I can, really, within reason. I don't have as many horses to compete as I used to, because I used to run a bit of a sales business, so we used to have lots of horses in that were going out constantly, but now I've just kind of got about 4 or 5 that I'm out competing with. So it's just enough. It's a really nice number, actually, to be able to focus on them all properly.
Yeah. And are there any there that you're particularly excited about for the future?
All of them, actually. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. No, I think they're all completely different and different characters, obviously, with different strengths. But I haven't got one that I'm riding that I'm like, oh, I don't think it can do a Grand Prix. I'm pretty certain, as certain as you can be at this stage, that they've all got what it takes to make it to Grand Prix. And I think until you actually get to Grand Prix, then you don't really know, you know, some horses suddenly to shine and some horses might not shine so much. But at this point, they're all showing willing and athletic ability enough to do it.
Amazing. That's a fabulous feeling, I'm sure, to have so many horses that you look forward to getting on every single day.
I think possibly I'm more excited by them now than I would have been like 10 years ago. Because I've realised it's not about necessarily having a really super flashy horse. It's just about having a horse that you love riding, that doesn't have physical ailments. You know, that's the hard bit, is keeping them on the road and on track. But actually, you know, if they're physically sound and they're willing and they want to work with you and you enjoy riding them, I know that they become, you know, they change so much through training. That before, where I might have thought, oh, it's a bit of a plain Jane, now I'm actually quite excited because I feel like the engine's in the right place and the brain's in the right place.
Okay. And when you said 10 years ago you might not have been as excited about these ones as you know, as you are now, what 10 years ago do you what I suppose what I'm asking is, what have you learned in the last 10 years that has changed that?
I think 10 years ago, I was very much fooled by the razzle dazzle, you know, and not so worried about temperament, and have ridden a lot of difficult horses. I love challenging horses. I don't know what it is about me. I think I just like making my life hard. I don't think there's such a thing as an easy horse either. I think they all have their challenges, but I was always won over by that kind of that one roguish horse that moved amazingly. and I would put so much time into it. And inevitably, they would never quite, they would come to a point where, like, you might get them to Pre-St. George and stuff, and they would find their niche there and they'd become happy. But I think for Grand Prix, they really have to want to do it. Mm. And they have to want to do it from quite early on. And I think that's the difference between a good and a great horse. Mm. And I think all the horses I've got now, they're quirky and they're sharp, but they all, every day I get on, they want to do work. And I think that I would take that over something now that trots for 9 or 10, but when you get on, it's like, doesn't really want to do it.
Yeah, I have that every day because I've got two horses that I've competed, and I haven't ridden to anywhere near the level that you have, but one of the horses is super talented but just really doesn't want to do it. In fact, it's the one that nearly killed me at the national, the winter championships just gone. And he's really quirky. And then I've got one who actually I own, and she's built downhill. She's an Irish draft cross thoroughbred. I bought her to go eventing on, but for various reasons I just don't have time at the moment to go eventing. And so she's doing dressage, and you know what, she can pirouette far better because she wants to do it. She can pirouette far better than the other horse can, because she doesn't just give up halfway through. And I enjoy riding, yeah. Really enjoying riding her, even though she physically doesn't find it easy, whereas the other one finds it so easy, but he just doesn't yeah. want to do it. He'd rather be yeah. leaving the warm-up at 500 miles an hour.
I mean, sometimes with those ones that are like, they find it so easy on the way up that they never really give you everything. They can have a late change though. They can have a late change in personality. I think some of them are just so slow to mature, the naughty ones, you know, mentally. And like, especially if they find everything easy, it's kind of like they don't have enough to think about. So they look for things to do to entertain themselves and make themselves really challenging to train. Sometimes those horses do come amazing at Grand Prix because everything gets hard.
I'm still waiting for it.
but you know, you have to keep your fingers crossed and just keep plugging away. I mean, you're in it now, you're training it. So you know what you've got to do is, like, you've got to make the best of it, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And it, even on the days where I just am banging my head against the wall, I have to think, no, I'm still going to get on it tomorrow and we're going to do a little bit better. And just take each day as it comes, I think, is the best way of looking at it. Because when you really want to get on and you really want a good ride and you want them to give you a good feeling, that's the day that they never do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think, again, that's something I think I've learned to do better over the years. It's like, it's managing expectations when you get on. I think, you know, like you say, you know, you get on and you're like, right, today I want to achieve this. I want to achieve ABC. I have a structured plan. And then you get on and the horse feels like shit, but feels bad. And you still, regardless, you try to stick to that plan. You still want to achieve A, B, and C, and you forget to address the fact that the horse doesn't feel very good. And it's not actually on side, and that actually scrap that. Today is a day for working on the basics or the gymnastics, and actually having that kind of flexibility in your training regime, you can make every day finish on a positive, as long as you're quick enough to realize that actually today's a day for basics, or today's a day that I can push for more.
And when did you learn that? Were you born knowing that, or when did you learn it?
No, I mean, it's something. It's not something you learn and it just stays with you. You have to keep relearning it. You know, I've learned it over the years as I've matured, and I would hope to say I'm less desperate than I was. I mean, we're still always desperate, aren't we? But I'm less desperate. And also, when I make that mistake now of trying to achieve more than, you know, where I've got my set goals and the horse isn't on side and I'm trying to do it and get frustrated, I know when I get off. I know straight away. Mm. I know exactly what I've done. I know that was a bad ride and that was my fault because I wasn't actually listening to what the horse was saying. I had you know, advanced medium 98 in my mind, and I was trying to practice it because I got the regionals coming up, and actually the horse was not on my aids, and I tried to do it anyway. My fault. You know, yeah. And it's just being quick enough to pick that up. And I think when you realize that you've done it, you don't want to do it again.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good way of learning it, a good way of explaining it, that you're actually constantly learning to manage your expectations. So in terms of kind of your horses now, where do you are you still training in terms of thinking about, obviously we train thinking about the long game, you know, we get on a horse and we always think, right, is this going to go to Grand Prix, and what do I need to teach it now in order to get it to Grand Prix? But is that still what gets you up in the morning to go and ride, or do you what I'm saying, I suppose, is do you still love it enough for that to be the sole thing to get you up in the morning?
It's absolutely it's what keeps me sane. You know, everything else that I do around it, and I've started playing in with social media this year a bit more and doing other things, but I was having this conversation the other day, and my number one priority is riding, because it's like that's what keeps me fresh and positive for everything else. I still always do that first in the day. You know, I always ride before I teach. I always ride before I do anything else, because I feel like it sets me up. It gives me that kind of positive outlook on the day. And I still have so much hunger and desire to be better than I am. And, you know, I want to train multiple, numerous Grand Prix horses. You know, that's like goal number one. I want every horse that I train to make it if they can. And obviously you need a bit of luck. But also I think, you know, if you're articulate and take your time and don't do stupid things, then hopefully you have a good chance of getting there. You know, every day just try to ride a bit better than I did yesterday, I suppose.
That's a really good way of looking at it, is riding better than you did yesterday, just a little bit better. It's those little gains, isn't it? And when it doesn't, you know, when they don't get to Grand Prix or they're injured or whatever, how is there anything to do with the resilience? How have you built up your resilience to deal with those pressure, those situations? Because there are so many rubbish days when you have horses, and a few really, really good ones. And I suppose we're constantly striving for the good ones, aren't we? But there are so many rubbish days. Yeah. What have you got, anything that you've learned to help you along the way?
I think, resilience kind of comes into it in so many different ways. When it comes to a horse going lame or having time off, I try to be as pragmatic as possible. Like, what can I do to make the horse better? You know, sometimes there's lots you can do, and sometimes your hands are tied, but it's just a matter of time, and sometimes they're not going to come right. I try to stay as positive as I can. I'm lucky in the situation I'm in, is in I've always got other horses to ride. So I think that's really hard if you're like a one horse rider. I imagine that's even more difficult. But you know, I've lost rides through, you know, people sell, I train them and then people sell them. That's happened all the way through my career and will continue to happen through my career, because that is the nature of the sport. You know, they become worth a lot of money, and then there's a risk in hanging on to them, isn't there? So what I've kind of realized is that I've always tried to bury my head in the sand about it and be like, oh, I'm fine. Just keep going, you know, like carry on. And actually, you're not fine. And I think one of the most important things for me is to actually address the fact that I'm upset about it, which sounds weird, because I think most people just would acknowledge they're upset. I very much just kind of head in the sand. I'm fine, you know, and actually I'm really not. And then the stress kind of builds up and it comes out in a different way. It comes out with physical ailments. I always end up, I have a constant sore throat. I have constant mouth ulcers and stuff like that in those times of stress. And that would then go on for ages, you know, and I'm like, right, okay. I think I have to acknowledge this now and actually make myself talk about it, but also taking positive action to, if it's avoidable, what caused you that stress, you know, so i.e. losing horses or whatever, being, you know, takeaway, what can I do, what's actionable that might be able to prevent this happening in the future, whether that be owning a percentage of a horse that if I ride a horse and I'm invested in it emotionally enough for it to upset me, then I need to action a way of maintaining that ride. So if it means me having to teach a few more clinics or, you know, think of different ways so I can earn more money to buy a share in that horse now, I will go without all of my luxuries to buy a share in that horse. And I think that knowledge, again, as you learn, as you've lost, I think now the horses that I'm riding, the majority of them I have a share in. So now I feel better. But with the lameness thing, I think that's just a toughie for everyone to swallow.
Oh, it's really difficult, isn't it? And if you're a one horse rider, I feel like that's even worse, isn't it? It's much more difficult. One of ours is off at the moment, and actually, you know, we had the vet out today for a reassessment, and I feel better having made a plan now, because you go through that phase of going, oh my goodness, this is just the worst thing ever. The horse is going really well and we've qualified for X, Y, and Z, and I really, you know, that was our target, and it goes lame just before that. That initial blow, I think, is so difficult to take. But then I feel like, yeah, I already feel more positive having made a plan about how we treat him. And then that kind of, there's a date for reassessment and all of that kind of stuff. So I think, I think making a plan for how you deal with it and try, so you buying a share in each horse, I suppose, is also controlling the controllables. Like, now you have more control over what happens to that horse. Is there another sport where you can put all those years of training into, you know, getting to the Olympics or WEG or whatever, and then it can just go like that, not through any fault, like not through injury, not through, I don't think there's another sport, like a tennis player can't have their racket suddenly sold.
It's a really, really tough one, because as well, you know, I see it from both aspects. You know, I was a horse dealer for a number of years, and I did it to myself, you know, on a lot of occasions when they got good, almost out of fear of, you know, that kind of like monkey on your shoulder saying, are you good enough? This horse is good enough. Are you good enough? You know, like, and I'd get it to the point where, okay, it's worth a load more money and people want to buy it, and I sell it.
Yeah.
And then I've always averted that kind of, like, when I've been feeling low or been stressed about other things, that's when, again, I'd make those decisions. You know, never be when I'm feeling great or feeling positive, I would have never sold those horses. But whether it was financial issues going on or something else, it was just like, okay, I'm not in the right frame of mind. The horse is worth money and I'll sell it. And I did that to myself more than it's been done to me. But I mean, it, like you say, it's almost, when you've done it to yourself, it's easier to swallow, because you can't blame someone else. But I get why, actually. There's so many reasons to sell, you know, when you own a horse, because of, like you just said, your horse went lame, you know. Or it could have a turn in form when it's going really well. It could suddenly have a turn in form, or it could go up to the next level and not cope. And suddenly that prospect that was looking really exciting and was desirable to a lot of people, was worth a lot of money, is now not. And there's always that risk at any point with a horse, something can change, can't it?
Something you just said was that you didn't believe that you were good enough at times. That's a really interesting point, because I'm sure a lot of people can relate to that. And to know that someone like you has self-doubt kind of makes me feel a little bit better, but also a little bit worse, because I'm not as good as you and you have self-doubt. So how do you get over self-doubt? How do you deal with that?
God, it's so hard. I mean, it really is, because you the thing with riding is, you only ever ride well when you're positive. You really are, like, you know, like, when you have a lesson with someone, you know, we've all been for lessons with someone where it's just negative critique, negative, negative, negative. You come out and you feel like crap, and you don't ride well. And I think managing then that, it can be super, super difficult. I think for me, that I have, it still happens. It still can happen easily. You know, like I felt before the regional, before, you know, usually before a big show. So you've got something looming over you where the pressure's on. And I had the regionals and Hartbury Premier League coming up 2 weeks ago. And it all started to, you know, I just felt like I'm not good enough. I'm not going to, you know, this, the horse is going well enough. I knew that. Like everyone that walked in the school was like, God, he looks amazing. This was not what I needed to hear. Cause like, I was like, I know he actually feels amazing. And I was almost scared to go to the show because I like my expectation then is I know this horse is going well enough to get 70%, maybe just over 70%. But am I good enough competitively? You know, like, am I going to make a stupid mistake? Am I going to warm him up right? Is my strategy right for the show? And actually, I'm so glad I acknowledged it rather than just going like, I was like, right, you need to, and it started to affect my riding. So that self-doubt, then I had one or two bad days and I was like, right, I'm riding like an idiot. Back to basics. And I just took my stirrups away. I bridged my reins and I just rode. I didn't try to do any movements. I just had 2 days of like, right, let the horse go and just sit. And within like 10 minutes of doing that, where you just strip bare, you're not trying to work on an exercise, you're just trying to ride at the best as you can, you know, sitting in the middle, in neutral, consistent contact, consistent rhythm, all just the basics. Literally 15, 20 minutes, I was back up there because I was like, oh, this horse feels amazing. You know, I'd stopped panicking, I'd stopped overriding or underriding and just rode. And I feel like having those tools in the bag, having an exercise that really works for you, or like for me, it's just taking away the stirrups and being closer to the horse or whatever, that really gives me my confidence back. But sometimes it's just, you know, when you're feeling like you're not good enough, it's really hard to think of those practical things that you can do rather than just negatively spiraling down and going, oh, I can't do it and I'm crap.
Yeah. That's a really difficult thing to pull yourself out of. But yeah, I think if you've got that exercise that you can revert to at any point, you know, whether it's in the lead up to a show like you were, or whether you're just having a problem with one movement or something, that's a really good, I don't think people take their stirrups away enough, and I don't think people bridge their reins enough, and this, I'm talking as a coach now, and I think it, and people are so desperate, certainly in dressage, since I've moved to dressage, it's not so much in eventing that I noticed it, but certainly in dressage, people get so obsessed with riding dressage things, and I'm using air quotes now, because I think people they don't separate just riding a horse from dressage. I think I train with Adam Kemp, and he says that until you get to a certain level, maybe elementary/medium, you're not doing dressage, you're horse influencing. And if you can influence a horse with your seat and you can influence your horse with your leg without needing to pull and push and, you know, shove and kick and everything, that's when you're moving to dressage riding. And that's generally when you get to elementary/medium level, I suppose, or doing a really, really good novice test. And so I've seen him quite often just work on horse influencing rather than dressage. And I feel like if we can bring ourselves back to just to riding or influence, you know, thinking about how we influence our horses, because that's all through, it's through our aids, so through seat, leg, hand, or all of that kind of stuff, but also it's through how we feel when we get on the horse, and we've got to remember that. And if that exercise, you know, bridging your reins and taking your stirrups away is what makes you remember how you influence the horse, I think that's a really powerful thing that you have in your toolbox. And I think maybe I might try if I'm having trouble, then I might try that too.
I think that for me, on the horse, that certainly helps. And off the horse, eat right, get enough sleep, all these basic things. But when you're stressed, it's really easy to not eat right. And not get enough sleep. And also, like, sometimes if I'm feeling really crap before I go to ride, I'll have a blast, like, of kind of, you know, whether it's a run or hit some weights or do something physical that gets my adrenaline up. Mm. And I feel like that pump can really, like, that can start your day so positive, and it can just snap you out of it. Mm. You know, again, it's like, whatever you do that makes you feel good, you know, you have to, as I get older, I'm more aware of, like, okay, when I do A, B, or C, it makes me feel great. Or when I do X, Y, Z, it makes me feel crap. I just try to do more of A, B, C and less of X, Y, Z, you know?
Mm. But that only comes with experience, doesn't it?
It sounds so obvious, but I'm still, you know, still, if I've been too stressed all week or whatever, and I'm like, you know, everything's getting me down, the temptation to go and drink, you know, two bottles of wine on Friday night, it's like, so then I feel great while I'm doing it. I'm like, oh, Sonic, you know, this is brilliant, you know, rah, rah, rah. But then Saturday's worse.
Yeah.
You know, so, and it's not like I'm definitely, if anyone knows me, they know that I'm not like a sober weirdo. I still enjoy drink, but drinking to excess to cover stress is never going to help, you know? Mm. So yeah, finding those kind of like clean habits that help you feel better about yourself, give you more confidence, you know, all of those things.
Yeah. And do you eat well on generally?
Right now, the last 3 days I've been eating great, but I was on holiday for a few days week before, and I was eating well. I was eating really well. I was eating everything I could get my hands on. So yeah, but I, again, it's one of those things I'm constantly having to address. I sometimes slip into, when I'm tired, I'll just order a takeaway. We end up ordering a takeaway 3 nights in 1 week, because when you start eating bad food, you crave bad food, and you just get into that habitual cycle of not looking after yourself. But right now we're eating great. So again, and I feel great for it. And I've been in the gym today and ridden a load and sweating, and I'm still sweating now, so I feel like I'm still burning the calories, which is great because it's so hot.
Yes.
But, yeah.
Good. Well, that's good. I mean, it's, yeah, the positive, I think just eating well, the positive out of that is that just eating well makes you want to eat well some more. But then equally, if you think, oh, do you know what, tonight I'm just going to have a takeaway and you know, a pizza or a Chinese or something, that's what you want again the next day. And that's so true.
Yeah.
Just trying to make sure that you don't lapse back into, because I do it as well, especially if, like, how busy are horse people in general, whether you're working in the industry as a groom or a rider or a coach or whatever, we're so busy, we try and squeeze as much as we can into one day. And then the temptation just to go and grab a takeaway on your way home or whatever is massive. It's definitely there. So trying to be organized, I found trying to be organized enough to actually have healthy food in the fridge and not just order a Domino's.
Do you know what? That is the difference this week. That's why I'm eating well, because I did a shop. I went to the shop and I bought food. Instead of just buying food for one day, I bought food for 3 days. Yeah. And again, this is like adulting 101, but I'm 35 and only just figured it out. But to do a weekly shop is amazing.
Yeah. There's a thing called a supermarket that you can go to. You can buy food for more than one day.
You can buy food from somewhere else other than Just Eat. I didn't realise.
That's the problem, though, is it's so easy to buy food from, you know, it is easy to get a takeaway because they just come and deliver it to your door.
I know.
And it's so much easier. Like, I hate going to the supermarket. I really hate it, but I've had to try and make it a positive thing by doing meal plans and things, so I don't go in there and just aimlessly grab things that I think, oh, that looks quite healthy.
It's lethal, because you can even get cocktails delivered to my house.
And oh, my God.
All the temptation is there, and yet to get a healthy meal, I have to get out and go down to the shop, walk around the shop with my mask on. I mean, it is a drag. But still, must do it.
Yeah, because you feel so much better having done it.
Yes. Yeah. That's... I'm so tempted to order a cocktail right now because we're talking about all.
Yeah.
It's a sunny evening. Why not?
Can I sit outside with a mojito?
Exactly. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, actually, it's just popped into my head. I've just become involved in the BD youth pathway as the coaching side. Obviously, I'm far too old to be in BD youth. And something I had a conversation with one of the BD youth director the other day about the support that riders get all the way through the system, whether they're, you know, whether they're coming at age 11 or whatever it is, 10 or 11, and they've got absolutely no interest in going to the national academies and the, you know, all of that. When you did it, you were probably birds, weren't you? Were you?
Yeah.
So it's a different system now. But they've obviously got the young people coming through that are focused on getting onto the podium potential pathway and all that kind of stuff. But their focus has shifted from producing athletes and the focus being on dressage, I suppose, defining the partnership or defining the young person, to creating well-rounded athletes instead. Not well-rounded athletes, well-rounded people instead of just focusing on dressage as the be-all and end-all. What was your experience of going through the youth system?
I thoroughly enjoyed it. To be honest, there's always some element of politics, I think. And for us, when I was part of it, and I was obviously part of the birds thing, and also I was on the world class, I think it was potential squad, I can't remember what it was called at the time, but anyway, so like the lottery funded thing pointing us towards the Olympics and stuff for the future. I was on that for 6 years. In a lot of ways, it was great because you had access to great trainers and nutritionists and all of that kind of stuff. And that was all, you know, thanks to coming through that bird system, I suppose. That was like the fledgling kind of beginning of it all. I found it on the whole just super positive thing to be a part of. It shaped my life. You know, that's why I'm doing, you know, obviously it works for me because it's led me down into a career path doing what I'm doing now. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that it's focusing now on making well-rounded people, but I would hate to think that they're losing a part of it, a segment of it that is directing people to elite sport, because at the end of the day, it is a sport and we want elite athletes coming through, you know, and this next generation of riders are going to have to be very good, you know, because the standard now of the riders in the world is incredible. You know, like the you know, 70% used to be, you know, top placing at the Olympics. Now, if you're not plus 75, you're not in the placing at all. You know, you're like, you're nowhere. And if you want a medal, you've got to be plus 80. It's a scary standard at the top. And I think we've got a nation full of riders and horse lovers, haven't we? You know, there's so many kids coming through doing it more than ever. And we do need to start the positive training that young if we're going to be competitive as a nation, and we all want to be, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. That it's interesting hearing your take on it, having been through it, and obviously you're still in the sport, because you hear a lot of, or I certainly have had an awful lot of the other side of it where. One more question. How did you find the jump from being a young rider? Because obviously, were you doing the under 25 Grand Prix and things?
No, there was no under 25 Grand Prix that came in after. So yeah, I went straight from young riders and then into the big wide world.
Into seniors. How did you find the jump into seniors?
Oh, it was a bit of a shock to the system. I mean, that was the one thing I think there could have been a bit more what I look back and think was missing was mentorship, really. Enough mentorship where you've got, you know, people around you that are going to guide you through how to become a professional. You know, I kind of wish, looking back, I wish I'd gone and based myself with a rider, but I didn't. I set up on my own, probably out of naivety more than anything, just believing I could do it because I'd had such success as a young rider. But it was definitely a big step up, a massive step up to Grand Prix, I felt. And I think I did my first Grand Prix at 21 or 22, maybe. But I did, you know, a couple of seasons, really rubbish Grand Prix. And then, you know, then trained another one to Grand Prix. And again, I did rubbish. And I think it was, I didn't do rubbish. I mean, Christ.
I'm sorry. Training two horses in a row to Grand Prix is not rubbish. It's very
relatively speaking, I was winning at small tour, you know, at Premier Leagues. And then with the second horse, 70%+. And then made the step up to Grand Prix with him. And it just didn't go as I had planned. I just wasn't good enough. You know, I hadn't ridden enough Grand Prix and I wasn't based with the trainer. The things I was working on at home with him was all about, you know, big moving and really like lovely forward and flowing, but I'd never trained him to collect in his life. Apart, you know, around Pre-St. George, you don't really need that much collection. You can do it quite in a nice forward way and then collect a little bit for your Harper or Waz round and get back out again, you know. that was it. So the horse, when he got to Grand Prix, was like a bit like, this is like a different language altogether. And I was like, yeah, I'm feeling it too, mate, you know. I think if I'd had kind of that mentor to kind of guide me through young riders to that next level, I think I would have been better prepared, because I just jumped in the deep end and tried to swim at that level and didn't really didn't manage it.
Yeah, I know that they're doing more in terms of that, because there are a few examples I can think of. I won't mention names, but they've come through they've come all the way from the bottom, really, of BD Youth, or they probably started in Birds, and now they're, you know, doing the a few of them rode at Hartbury the other day in the CDI. I think that they have now recognized the need for a mentor to try and help them step through from the, but they would have done the under 25s as well, the Grand Prix, the under 25s Grand Prix. So I suppose that in itself is a bit more of a stepping stone, isn't it? Into the,
I think so, definitely. Yeah. But again, you've got that. I don't know if they even have, do they have a team trainer anymore or anything like that? You know, the under 25s or the under 20s.
I don't think it's necessarily called a team trainer, but they have people that are helping. Yeah.
Yeah. It's strange because, you know, once you're out of it, you never really look back and see, you know, think, how is it working? So I'm really kind of clueless. But I'm interested to know what what people have said that are like the negatives about it. You know,
part of the reason that I really wanted to do the BDU stuff is I enjoy doing the Pony Club and helping and trying to help kids not just be, I suppose, defined by whether they win or lose on their ponies. And because otherwise I think you lose what you've still got, i.e. you want to get up and ride every morning. And we often are in danger of losing young people through that, and feeling like it really matters if I win or lose. If you set a goal and you want to achieve it, then absolutely to you it matters if you win or lose, but you're not defined by your losses. You're also not defined by your wins. And having seen an awful lot of that in various sports, you know, whether it's horses or motor racing or, you know, tennis, that kind of thing, I have seen an awful lot of that. That's partly why I wanted to get into the BD Youth side of things. And I have heard, just through, it's not necessarily talking to it takes a long time for people to start talking about it, about where they felt let down by a system that actually overall they really, really enjoyed the experience of. But it's just interesting now that I actually have a little bit of just tiny little bit of influence now. It's just interesting to hear where it could do better for people. And so what you're saying is interesting, i.e. the mentors, you know, someone to help you go from being a young rider to a senior. But equally, I think the all-round athlete, I suppose, if we're still focusing on the ones that are going to go all the way to the to be within the sport and aiming at the elite, so the nutrition, the hydration, the mental side of it, all of that, I think now is being addressed far better than it might have been in the past. And teaching people resilience and how to cope with the pressure that they feel and all that kind of thing, because there are so many different competitions that people can go out and do now. So there are so many more people who are being exposed to a championship of some kind, whether it's the regionals, nationals, area festivals, whatever. It's so accessible for people now, which is amazing. But I just want to know that the, especially the young people, are being taught the resilience to deal with the championship situation that they are going to be faced with.
I think the biggest thing, having witnessed it firsthand, and what I would say about the pressures of competing, and also, you know, not, you know, being able to deal with the fact that you're not going to win every time, is the riders when I was doing young riders and ponies and all of that are still going now, had very supportive parents, in as much as, you know, if it didn't go right, they were cool about it. You know, like my mum and dad were always like, just do your best and your best is good enough. And there were other kids that the parents were very competitive. And I feel the one thing BD could have done better was manage those parents.
That's because actually,
do you know what? Those kids have all given up. All those kids that I read with that were like, they were getting told off in the lorry if they hadn't, you know, if they made a mistake or whatever. And they were all so stressed about competing before they'd even started. Inevitably, they were going to make mistakes, you know? Mm. And I'm super lucky. My mum and dad were so cool. And most of the parents were, but I think, you know, there's probably quite a few that were very talented riders that aren't riding now at all because of that early pressure put on them. But I certainly think more of that pressure came from within the family rather than from BD or from a team trainer that was a bit of a dragon, or, you know, definitely from what I saw anyway. I think that is where you definitely, it's not, and that's never an easy thing, is it, for an organization to step in between mother and father and child. But I mean, some parents do need a slap around the head and told to shut up. So you see it in Pony Club as well, don't you?
I was just going to say, I've learned parent management from Pony Club.
Yeah.
15 years of teaching Pony Club.
Yeah.
You get quite good at managing parents.
Yeah. They start living their dreams vicariously through their child, and it's just dangerous, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's sad when they do give up, because those children inevitably do give up. And they, even in Pony Club, you see that they're being they're really lovely riders, and they, they have various amounts of success, but then they have so much pressure from their parents that actually they don't feel like they're enjoying it anymore. They hate it. I don't know whether you've read, this is going completely off topic for a second, but I don't know whether you've read anything about Andre Agassi and how he felt about playing tennis. He absolutely hated tennis, but it was his dad that made him play tennis. But he, every single time he hit a tennis ball, but he was winning competitions, he was winning Grand Slams, hating it every single time he hit a ball. He absolutely hated it. And it was only, and he started doing really, really well when he learned to love it again, but he, for a while, he absolutely hated it. And I found that so interesting from, especially for, like, from a coach's point of view, how his psychology must have worked, getting up every morning and thinking, oh my God, I've got to do that awful thing again, like play tennis. It's really rubbish that I'm really good at it and I've got to do it.
Yeah. Maybe it helped him. I mean, yeah, maybe possibly. maybe he played well frustrated, but I don't think you could. I don't know. Well, maybe you could do it on a horse, but I just don't think that would work on a horse. Do you? I don't think you could ride every day thinking I hate this without the horse being like, well, I hate this too. Then, yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's got to be down.
But you see it. You do see it, though. I've noticed it, and not in anyone I teach, but I've noticed it in other riders. And there are a few that I've watched, and I've thought, are you actually genuinely enjoying that, or are you just doing it because you don't know anything else?
Yeah.
Like, what was your did you go to like college and all of that and get normal qualifications? So it's all just been horses.
It has, yeah. But again, I think that you see, like you say, when as a coach you see it all the time. Half of the lessons I teach, the first 5 or 10 minutes of it is dealing with someone's negativity. You know, the people, they come, they invest so much emotion, and this isn't like, I'm not slagging these people off. It's a total normal thing to happen. But I know, you know, having taught thousands and thousands and thousands of lessons, when people come in that frame of mind, nothing I say is going to make that horse better. So while they're feeling like that. So the first 5 or 10 minutes, I don't try to make them improve in any way at all. I just try to bring them around, like snap them out of it, bring them into a good mood, make them think positive, stop them on that kind of thought process before I ever kind of start passing on critique or information.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. Sometimes that might take 5 or 10 minutes. Sometimes that might take half the lesson. But I tell you what, I know now that you have to just kind of, if even if it's like, just doing walk exercises until they kind of have simmered down, because they'll get themselves in a fluster when they've got there and they come in and tell you, oh, well, this went wrong and that went wrong at the last show that I went to, and now I can't do this and I can't do that. And you're like, right, okay. Well, until you actually stop hyperventilating, there's nothing I can do about it. Do you know what I mean?
That's a good people skill to have, to know when someone's ready to work.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, honestly, I've made the mistake of pushing too soon, and it never works well.
No, well, you want to come out feeling positive from a lesson as well. And if you're if they come push back at you the whole time, it's horrible as a coach.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So just to wrap up, because I'm very conscious of your time. I want you to give our listeners 3 tips if they're going out competing, not necessarily just to do with their mental preparation, but to do with just generally being ready as a rider to go out and absolutely nailing the next competition.
Okay. Well, record yourself. If you can't have a lesson in the week before, record yourself, set the camera up on the edge of the school. If you've got nothing else, if you've got a Pivo, use it. The Pivo has revolutionized my test riding this year.
Oh, really?
Really has, honestly. You know, I can literally set it up 3 times a week, 4 times a week, and just watch back. Okay. And then address what I'm feeling. And then I go back and watch it again. Because what you're feeling and what you're seeing aren't always correlating. So that definitely, watch yourself back. 2, if you're going out competing, learn your tests, people. Honestly, it's not that hard. It's 4 or 5 minutes long. You know, it like so many people just don't, you know, they come to me like, oh, I haven't read it yet. And I'm like, they go wrong. Or they're so panicked about remembering it. All they can think about in the test is remembering the test. And then they come out and they remembered the test, but they forgot to ride. So yeah, just learn your tests. Next time I go wrong, I'm going to get so much stick. And 3 would be to just learn to enjoy the process. You know, try. It's hard, and I even, you know, like I said before the last big shows I did, I got stressed about it. But that's another important reminder to myself that actually you have to enjoy the process, and then actually competing. Okay, some days it will go for you, and some days it will go against you. That is horses in general. But if you learn to enjoy actually the preparation and getting ready, then you've already won.
Amazing. Enjoy it. That's the biggest thing, definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Marvellous. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's really kind of you.
That's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.